The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
She's won the battle, but can she win the war? Theresa May survives a confidence vote in her leadership. A better deal, Arlene Foster teams up with former Brexit secretaries in a bid to bin the backstop. And what's another year? Micheál Martin agrees to prop up the government until 2020. All that and more on tonight's Late Debate, but first the news with Gail Conway. Thanks, Gail. Good evening and welcome to The Late Debate with Katie Hannan. Now, on the night that's in it, we'll be going to guests in London and Belfast for their take on the latest events in Westminster. But first, let me introduce our distinguished studio panel. We have Fine Gael Party Chairman and TD for Kildare South, Martin Hayden, Fianna Fáil Senator Lorraine Clifford-Lee, Sinn Féin TD for Carlow Kilkenny, Kathleen Funchian, John McGrain, the Director General of the British Irish Chamber of Commerce and political correspondent with the Irish Times, Harry McGee. Now, if you want to contribute to our debate, please do. All your comments are welcome and we try to include as many as we can. You can text us on 51551, email us on latedebate@rte.ie or tweet to @latedebaterte. Now, tonight, Theresa May has survived that confidence vote in her leadership. In a secret ballot of her parliamentary party, she won the support of almost two-thirds of her MPs, with 200 of them voting confidence in her, while 117 voted against. So how did she do it? Here is Theresa May speaking this morning as she readies herself for her longest day.
Sir Graham Brady has confirmed that he has received 48 letters from Conservative MPs, so there will now be a vote of confidence in my leadership of the Conservative Party. I will contest that vote with everything I've got. I spent yesterday meeting Chancellor Merkel, Prime Minister Rutte, President Tusk and President Juncker to address the concerns that MPs have with the backstop, and we are making progress.
And this is Theresa May rallying her troops on the floor of the Commons.
The meaningful vote has been deferred and the date of that vote will be announced in the normal way. The business motion will be agreed and discussed in the usual way. Well, if he says when, I'll tell members on the other side when we've had a meaningful vote. We had it in the referendum on 2016. And if he wants a meaningful date, I'll give him one. 29th of March 2019 when we leave the European Union.
And shortly after the result of today's confidence vote was announced on the stroke of 9 o'clock this evening, this is Theresa May's response.
I'm pleased to have received the backing of my colleagues in tonight's ballot. Whilst I'm grateful for that support, a significant number of colleagues did cast a vote against me, and I've listened to what they said. For my part, I've heard what the House of Commons said about the Northern Ireland backstop. And when I go to the European Council tomorrow, I will be seeking legal and political assurances that will assuage the concerns that members of Parliament have on that issue.
Theresa May speaking a short while ago. I'm joined on the line now by John Rintoul, the Chief Political Commentator with the UK Independent. Thanks for joining us on this very busy night, John. I believe you're back in the same corridor you were standing in the last time a Eurosceptic tried to oust a Tory leader. That was John Redmond challenging John Major back in 95.
Yes, that seems like quite a long time ago. I mean, that was a slightly different a kettle of fish, because John Major actually stood down as leader, which you can't do under the rules now, and invited people to challenge him. And Michael Portillo famously failed to do so, but John Redwood stepped forward, and it was a very similar result to the one we had tonight, about two-thirds voting for the Prime Minister and one-third voting against.
So, yeah, she reached the magic 200 mark that people were talking about earlier today, but has she done enough?
Well, yes, she has. I mean, you know, one vote would have been enough, but it's not a very good margin for her. I mean, 117 voting against her was on the high-ish side. But the important thing is that under the party rules, that means there can't be another attempt to unseat her for 12 months, which means that, you know, she has a bit of space to try and solve the Brexit problem, but that problem hasn't changed in the slightest, and the numbers in the UK House of Commons are exactly as they were before. And she's got no way of getting her deal approved yet.
What does this do for the hardline Brexiteers, the ERG? I mean, will this chasten them, this outcome?
Well, it ought to. I mean, it ought to underline the limits of their power. I mean, 117 is probably about as many as they can get against the deal. And that's a minority in the House of Commons. As you know, 117 out of 650 is not enough to dictate anything, but it's enough to get in the way. But it's not enough to get what they want, which is for us to leave without a deal. But it still gives them enough numbers to stop the Prime Minister getting what she wants, which means that the sort of three-way gridlock in Parliament is nowhere near being solved.
I think we actually have a clip of Jacob Rees-Mogg speaking a short time ago. Let's have a listen to that now, John.
And I think the Prime Minister should resign. She cannot get her deal through. Her very bad, unsatisfactory withdrawal agreement, which is not supported by the DUP, by many Conservatives or by the opposition. And having failed in her main plank of policy, it would be constitutionally normal for her to retire from the fray.
Well, I suppose Jacob, not that surprising that Jacob Rees-Mogg would take that position this evening, but... Is she, having had to concede that big concession today, that she will not lead the Tory party into another election, is she something of a lame duck leader now?
Oh, well, I think she was. She was anyway. That was a recognition of the reality. She tried to persuade some Tory MPs who might have had doubts about voting for her because they thought they might be cementing her in position for the next election. She made it explicit that she won't be taking them into the next election. But, you know, I mean, Jacob Rees-Mogg is still refusing to face the reality that if he and his colleagues continue to obstruct the Prime Minister, they are going to push her towards postponing Brexit and holding a referendum. And that means that the purists on the Brexit side are in danger of losing Brexit altogether.
Is that now looking like a more likely outcome? I mean, we know we have this deal. We're hearing from Europe that there is going to be, at the most, clarifications offered, reassurances offered, but nothing in the way of any change to legal text or any protocols. So,
well, there can't be, because, I mean, you either have a guarantee of an open border in Ireland or you don't. And there's just no way around that one. And so people like Jacob Rees-Mogg sort of imagine that there's some kind of third way are, I'm afraid, kidding themselves.
So talk me through what we're expecting to happen now. Are we expecting any vote before the new year now?
No, I don't think so. I mean, there could be a vote next week. I mean, you know, I suppose, if EU leaders suddenly decided, you know, they didn't want this guarantee of an open border in Ireland, you know, which they're not going to do because, I mean, they're very big on solidarity with Ireland. Then you know she might come back and put it to the vote, but otherwise it's going to be January before we try to vote on it again. But this she still has no prospect of getting it through. I mean, there may be the penny may start to drop with some Conservative members, but she hasn't got any support from the Labour benches, which she is going to need in the end in order to get this through, and she's got no sign of getting any Labour support from the opposition.
Okay, so this eventually does go before the Commons. It gets rejected. What are we facing then? Then we're left with the two options, no deal or no Brexit.
I think the two options will come down to Theresa, because the no-deal option only has 117 supporters in the House of Commons, as we discovered tonight. So, actually, the more popular options are Theresa May's deal or a referendum. And I think that is where you might start to split the Labour Party, because there are quite a few Labour MPs who would be very uncomfortable voting to postpone Brexit and have a referendum. So, you know, if she can force the House of Commons to face that choice, she has to break away some Labour votes onto her side, but whether there'll be enough to get her deal through is, you know, just looks very, very difficult at this stage.
So ultimately, John, what has changed? What has tonight's vote done to this Brexit chaos situation? You know,
well,
where has it taken us? Has it taken us anywhere that we weren't 24 hours ago?
Well, it has ruled out one fantasy option, which is the idea that the Conservative Party can just change its leader and that will somehow magically transform the situation. You know, by sheer force of personality, Boris Johnson was going to sweep in and bully the EU into giving us a completely different deal. I mean, so at least that kind of fantasy option has been emphatically ruled out. And it means that the UK House of Commons, you know, the options are narrowing. It has to face up to the choice, the realistic choices in front of it, which are to leave without a deal, to go for Theresa May's deal, or to postpone Brexit and have a referendum. I mean, that is really the only... you may be able to squeeze in a sort of Norway plus type option there, but I mean, that would be even less popular with the Conservative benches. That would end up being a Labour Brexit, and you'd probably need a Labour Prime Minister for that.
Okay, John, thank you for joining us with that this evening. I'll let you go because I want to open this up to the studio, our studio panel now. Harry McGee, I presume there was a sigh of relief in government buildings tonight with the outcome of this vote.
There was, but there is a kind of a frisson of uncertainty. If anyone had been listening to the live broadcast and Sir Graham Brady announcing the result, he said that Theresa May continues to have the confidence of the Conservative Party, and there was a huge cheer that went on for several minutes. And then he announced the actual result. And when it became known that there were 117 who had voted against her, there was an audible oomph from the pro-May camp.
Because they had been briefing in the hours before that outcome that they were expecting no more than 80 to vote against her.
Well that was, it was more than people had anticipated. And the pro-Brexiteers, we heard Jacob Rees-Mogg there a while ago, but on the way in I was listening to Peter Bone, who'd be an ardent Brexiteer, saying that a third of the parliamentary party are against it, and she's a dead duck or a lame duck Prime Minister. And they're referring to this payroll equation, that so many of those who voted for Miss May have some emolument of some kind of job. They're ministers or parliamentary secretary, or they're getting extra, so it's in their interest to support her. And
but that basically she's lost the backbenches.
Yeah, that's
lost the majority of the
number 150. They didn't all vote for her, of course, but the majority of them probably.
Well,
did.
You must also factor in the fact that John McGrane, that some of that vote, some of the 200 votes that she did get from her MPs would have come from Remainers, who would have, you know, been thinking of the prospect of, if not her, who would they be dealing with?
Yeah, that's the challenge that they have. So, I mean, your question was, you know, what has changed, what has moved on? It's what happened just before this. So what happened just before this morning was the call of a no-confidence vote, and suddenly we had a whole new uncertainty piling onto massive uncertainty in the process thus far. So what we've got tonight is that one piece of uncertainty has been taken off the table. So, you know, that's a good thing.
One known unknown
dealt with, and she now has to get back to work. And she has a colossal job of work to do, because the underlying matter is still the exact same. There's a lot of talk about sort of three options, you know, no deal, the withdrawal agreement or the political declaration with it, or a referendum. But the referendum isn't on the table right now. And from a business and jobs point of view, this is getting really late in the day. If she runs this into mid-January, which is probably what she's doing now, we've then got less than 2 months until exit day, and right now that's leaving things very precarious for businesses that are already struggling to prepare for some unknown. They're telling them that they've only got 2 months at that point to know what the outcome actually is a dreadful place for businesses to be placed in.
Martin Hayden, I see that the Taoiseach was telling you about his talked with Juncker today at your parliamentary party. He told the parliamentary party meeting that the Brexit withdrawal date could be extended, but that preparations for a no deal would continue. Do you think there was a serious discussion this evening about extending that date?
No, I actually don't think, Katie, that anything has kind of changed from 24 hours ago. I think today's conference vote has been a distraction, but we are now, with that result, we are back to where we were 24 hours ago, in exactly the same position. And it's really a matter now of what way the UK go from here. It is very clear that there's a majority of people in the House of Commons, MPs in the House of Commons, who do not want a no-deal Brexit. But that is the default position. Something has to change for that not to happen. And if nothing happens between now and 29th of March, that is what happens.
Lorraine, do you think that after that Dominic Grieve amendment was passed a couple of weeks ago now, do you think that the MPs in the Commons can stop a no deal Brexit, a crashing out of from the EU?
Well, I think what has changed is perhaps the timeline on all of this. And, you know, we're talking about perhaps the middle of January before this deal is coming back before the Commons. There might be a vote on it. At least we know exactly what the strength of the opposition to that deal is. So that at least that's known. But like was said there, that the options are narrowing, and it's going to be a very difficult number of weeks now as Theresa May goes off on her tour again and tries to get legal and political assurances. And I think from our point of view, we just need to hold fast.
But we're holding fast. It's an extraordinary, Kathleen Fungian, it's an extraordinary situation we're in, where there is pretty much nobody who believes that Theresa May is going to get any concessions that will help her get sell this deal to any Brexiteers or Remainers or all the people who are railed against it in the Commons. So, and as John was saying, their time is running out.
Yeah, I think it shows just from the very onset, and I think probably most people on the panel will agree with this, that Brexit has been just a complete disaster from day one. And, you know, it just shows the recklessness and the irresponsibility of people that proposed it, but having absolutely no idea how they were going to deal with it. I do agree with Martin in terms of the no confidence motion being a bit of a distraction. But in fairness, I think she has come out frightened from that. And while I certainly wouldn't really agree with anything that Theresa May stands for, I do think that she's shown kind of great strength really over the last few days in dealing with all this. There absolutely has to be a deal. And I don't think anybody in power, whether it's here in Ireland, whether it's in England or in Europe, we cannot have a situation where there's not a deal. I think that this deal probably, I know it's looking dodgy and doubtful whether it'll get over the line, but I think
it's
I don't think it's impossible. I think that there will be probably interventions. There absolutely has to be a deal. We can't have a situation for us here particularly where there's question marks or doubts over a border or a hard border. We can't go back to any sort of days where there was a border. And I do think that there's, you know, a responsibility now on the European leaders and everyone to get in behind this and ensure, you know, whether or not
they can. What can they do?
I'm sure there is a possibility of extending the deadline. I mean, they announced in the last few days or last week that they can decide now not to have a Brexit and they don't need the consent of the other European countries to do that. So there's all sorts of possibilities. And it's the thing is as well, it's so unpredictable and it's so changeable. Literally from day to day, anything can happen. But there's such a huge responsibility on all of us to ensure that there is a deal, and particularly for us here, that protects the North and the businesses and the communities and the people that are crossing over the border every single day. It's really, really important.
Harry, that idea that there could be an extension, you'd have to think that if that was being seriously considered, that they're not going to allow an extension so that the Tory party can continue to tear itself apart without any possibility of some dramatic change to the outcome.
Well, I mean, at this stage, I mean, an extension looks inevitable to me because they're not coming back to vote on it until January, and that'll just leave them 2 months to work out kind of future relationships, and that's just too short a time frame. And we've seen deadlines being imposed in the peace process in the North and then being parked and kind of put back. So I don't see any reason why this process can't be put back by 6 months or by a year.
What end, though? What would it be put back for another referendum?
To allow issues to be crystallised. She's definitely hardened her stance. And one of the things that she was saying today is that she will be looking for political and legal assurances that the backstop in the North won't be permanent. And that's, of course, a very tricky proposition. We had the former British Minister Dominic Raab talking about Britain leaving the backstop after a period of only 3 months. But the only way in which they could guarantee that the backstop could be withdrawn was if the agreement that governing future relationships was so comprehensive and so mutually compatible that the need for a backstop would be obviated. And that's to do that, they will need to spend a lot of time negotiating and going through the detail of it. So for me, I mean, if the vote's not going to take place on the 21st of January, that means that, to me, an extension is inevitable and necessary.
But I think that the problem with that, though, is that, you know, there will be never a situation where everybody in the Tory party realises that the North of Ireland is different. They cannot get their heads around that it's constitutionally and culturally and legally different to the rest of the UK, and that's our position here in the South, and that will always remain our position. So it's very, very difficult to see how they'll overcome that.
What I think is going to happen is, if you look at the Northern peace process, if you look at the kind of seemingly irreconcilable interests involved, the DUP and Sinn Féin, who both came from almost polar opposites, and the official unionist party who were there at the time, or the ultra unionist party, And what happened was that where there were difficulties, they tended to just include protocols or kind of park issues.
But that was all right when we had an overarching body like the European Union, where we had parity of esteem, and that it seems to be torn apart. Like you could operate in that sphere and have an overarching agreement, an overarching kind of gatekeeper on it, and that's been taken away now. So it's very difficult to see how competing interests.
What might happen is that they might agree to say, 97% of what's required, and then the other 3%, they look at a process whereby that can actually be put into.
But an extension isn't going to
escrow
be,
for a little while.
An extension isn't going to be offered just to allow the same situation move on. And sometimes in negotiations, you need a deadline to force everybody up to the edge of it. The problem there is everybody in the middle, from business to citizens and everybody who needs to make decisions to be able to plan into the future. It's very difficult on everybody involved if we go up to the 11th hour. But I don't see any extension being offered in the immediate future, because that would just allow this period of significant stability to be extended.
If things go to the 11th hour, Martin, and there's no deal, if the prospects of a no-deal Brexit are becoming very real, you must try to explore some kind of alternatives that attempt to do it.
Of course you would.
I think a deadline is a very good thing to have to impose discipline and to make sure that everybody arrives at a particular point. But sometimes negotiations can be very difficult, and sometimes you need to be imaginative, and sometimes you need to give an extension of time, or then you have to begin to look at site alternatives to get around obstacles.
And absolutely, if there's a clear roadmap the future would look like, I don't see the Irish government will not be standing in the way of an extension.
I just want to read out a few tweets that are coming into us. One for you, Harry. What's your issue with pro-democracy Brexiteers, Harry McGee? We have, why is secret ballot? The Irish media always wanted the late Charlie Hawley to have an open ballot when his leadership was challenged. Where's the anti-democratic Eurotrash call for a second vote? Can we give ground on backstops, is another texter. UK, very important to us, and hard Brexit, bad for us if Theresa May fails on agreement. I mean, you've hailed the backstop, it was bulletproof, there was press conferences, it was seen as a big win for Leo Varadkar and Simon Coveney in their negotiations. But ultimately, all of that matters not a toss if they fall off the edge and crash out of Brexit.
Ultimately, the backstop, and people get very confused as to what the backstop actually is, it's a guarantee based around red lines that the British government have introduced. And if British government and some of their red lines are probably contradictory, which leaves them in the bind that they're in. But because the British government wanted no checks between GB and Northern Ireland, but also accept that they don't want any hard border on the island of Ireland, nor do we, then the backstop is inevitable, as we hope it will never be used, but it has to be there as a guarantee.
Okay, we'll leave it this part of the discussion for now, because I want to take a break, and after that break we will be going to Belfast.
Email latedebate@rte.ie. The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And you're welcome back. In studio with us this evening, we have Fine Gael Party Chairman Martin Hayden, Fianna Fáil's Lorraine Clifford Lee, Sinn Féin's Kathleen Funtian, John McGrain, the Director General of the British Irish Chamber of Commerce, and the Irish Times' political correspondent, Harry McGee. Now, let's hear how this outcome of the confidence vote is likely to be viewed by unionists north of the still frictionless border, but for how long? Joining me now is Ben Lowry, Deputy Editor of the Belfast Telegraph. Ben, how will this play in Belfast?
I'm actually with the Belfast newsletter. But
apologies. I mistyped it myself.
I was once with the Belfast Telegraph. But anyway, that's not the important thing. I think that we're all as confused as we were because of the fact that this is a vote that keeps Theresa May in office. I think it's quite psychologically important that she reach the 200 barrier if it had been 196. So that isn't great for the DUP, because the DUP said, laterally they've been saying, our deal is with the Conservative Party, it's not with Theresa May, so it would have suited them to have another leader. And that isn't a great situation for them, that they are going to be, because they're not going to bring down the government, certainly not at this stage, they're going to be propping up a leader that they don't want, and to whom they have been, about whom they have been disparaging. in the House of Commons. So relations are very bad. But I think that they will be taking encouragement from the fact that 117 MPs is a really serious number of MPs voting against the Prime Minister. And not only that, if that had been translated into, I mean, that's the highest figure I heard for Tory MPs who might have voted against the withdrawal agreement. I think it was something like 104. If that had been translated into the withdrawal agreement, you'd have been talking about a defeat of perhaps 200, which would be catastrophic. So the uncertainty is that where do we go from here? The withdrawal, it's very hard to see how the withdrawal agreement survives, and therefore the backstop within the withdrawal agreement survives. But of course, Ireland and your panelists, some of your panelists and the EU have been saying that the backstop's never going to go away. And Theresa May, which is very disappointing from a unionist perspective, but the fact of the matter is she stepped up this rhetoric that the backstop is not going away.
What do you make of this move today with Arlene Foster joining forces with those former Brexit secretaries, David Davis and Dominic Raab, for this so-called better deal drive?
What I think it illustrates is something you're not going to hear many unionists say, moderate unionists, yes, but what you're not going to hear them saying is clearly the if this had never happened, if we had stayed in the European Union, there would be no possibility and no prospect of constitutional damage from a unionist point of view. But they are certainly not going to say that, and they have necessarily allied themselves to the only people that they really can ally themselves to, which is Brexiteers. And they've come up with this report today, which talks about, for example, a 10-year extendable backstop and that kind of thing. So I think it is a logical alliance, but it's the problem with all of these things is that there's a majority for nothing. We're in this completely rudderless and unprecedented situation in which nothing is going to get it. There's talk about Norway for now as having a majority. And I suppose the only thing that would be encouraging from an EU and Ireland perspective would be that there is a complete determination to avoid no deal. And, you know, I think that if you were taking a purist unionist line on it, you would be wanting to see no deal because you would just say, well, this is just intolerable. That there's, I mean, to get into a backstop that we can't get out of, to be in this, my reading of the backstop, people say different things about it. My own reading of it is it means that Northern Ireland can never leave the EU regulatory or customs space. That is quite an incredible concession for a British government to make in any situation, let alone a Conservative and Unionist government, let alone a Conservative and Unionist government propped up by a Unionist party. Strictly from a unionist point of view, you'd want the backstop. You would want there to be no deal, but the MPs will find a way to thwart it, I think.
But what about business leaders and farmers groups in the north? I mean, they support this deal. Is there not pressure coming on the DUP from the grassroots up to move on this in some way?
I think it is fair to say that the DUP is not in a good place. If there was an election tomorrow, yes, they'd win it, or they and Sinn Féin would romp home and be the largest parties. There's no doubt about that, because society is as polarised in Northern Ireland in many respects as it's ever been. But they're not otherwise in a good place. They're not in a good place because they are... they were very proud and they talked a lot about this relationship with the Conservative Party, and that's hanging by a thread. And now, as you say, the business community really has effectively come out against them. And I must say, again, to try to give your listeners a unionist perspective, it's pretty alarming that, I mean, if the interpretation that I laid out there that potentially Northern Ireland is coming out of the UK internal market and all this de-dramatisation of the border in the Irish Sea, certainly there'll be checks from GB, Great Britain to Northern Ireland. By far, by a long distance, our biggest trade. And yet businesses, as you say, I was talking to a very senior person in the farming community today. I said, are you not at all concerned about this? They're not giving DUP support. So that isn't a good place for the DUP, because they would traditionally see themselves and traditionally have been a pro-business party with good links to that.
And how about, I have Kathleen Funchian from Sinn Féin in the studio with us. I just want to maybe ask her to put you what Mary Lou MacDonald was putting to the Taoiseach in the Dáil today in relation to the necessity for to plan for a vote on the border, a border poll.
Yeah, well, I think the point she was making is that if we're in a situation where there's a hard Brexit or no deal, that there is a provision in the Good Friday Agreement to have a border poll, and that that is obviously the obvious solution if we do not have a deal. But I think in reality, what we need to see is a deal being negotiated, because I don't know whether or not we'd actually, you know, what the outcome of that would be at the moment. But I think it is important that we do have, I mean, the Good Friday Agreement is an international agreement, and it's important that that's protected and that the peace process that was so hard fought for is safeguarded. So, I mean, the reality is if there is no deal, we will have to look at a border poll situation.
Ben, how is that talk from Sinn Féin going down with unionists?
Well, Sinn Féin have always pushed for a border poll. I think it would be very alarming to unionists if Leo Varadkar was pushing for a border poll, and he's not. One of the things that I often, when I'm asked about this, say, I mean, Britain has been very generous about this. It says that Scotland can go 50% plus one, and it says that Northern Ireland can go 50% plus one. So if we reach a point where the polls unequivocally show support for Irish unity, there will be a border poll. That's that. It's just going to happen. And there is a debate within unionism about what to do about that. In a way, Peter Robinson recently was saying, bring it on. I wrote a column a few years ago before Scotland was even on the cards for a referendum, before Brexit was even thought of, 5 or more years ago, saying we really need to bring this on. I am encouraged by some of the detailed polling that's been done in Queen's University and so on, face-to-face polls, which still show very low support for Irish unity. But I think it is helpful that at this point in time, relations between London and Dublin are not so bad that Simon Coveney and Leo Varadkar are pushing for a border poll, because a border poll clearly at this point in time would be pretty horrendous.
And getting back to the situation in Westminster and May's reliance on those 10 DUP MPs, in a situation where she presses on with this deal, she presents it again, whether before or after or in the new year, to the Commons, is there a situation where Labour could push a vote of confidence in the government? And in that scenario, would Theresa May be able to rely on her those 10 votes from the DUP?
Well, it's a good question, Matt. And in a sense, the thing that you have to watch more is the moderate Tories. Because let us say that Theresa May had lost today, or let's say that things deteriorate and then she loses. People like Anna Soubry and Dominic Grieve, these very pro-EU voices within the Conservative Party, have made clear that their involvement with the Tory party will cease at that point. And it only takes a very small number for that to happen. Just before I came on here, I had a chat with Sammy Wilson, the DUP MP, who's very outspoken, and he said that if the withdrawal agreement goes through, let's be clear about this, he was saying, the relationship and with the agreement is over, with the Conservatives is over. So I think that they are not going to be supporting toppling the government, and that is probably why Labour has not yet brought this motion. But we're into one of the unprecedented scenarios. I was saying there's all sorts of unprecedented scenarios. We're really into zombie government territory, because because we have a fixed term parliament, if the government is not toppled in a no confidence motion, and if it can't get through its key legislation, remember, of course, the DUP flexing its muscles by withdrawing support in other votes for other government business, then you could have a situation now, particularly now that Theresa May is secure for a while, of zombie government unable to do anything, and the Brexit deadline fast approaching.
Indeed. OK, we'll let you go, Ben Lowry. Thanks for joining us with that tonight. I'll go back to my studio panel now. John McGrain.
Yeah, I mean, like, we've been talking about sort of the polar opposite positions here in terms of the, you know, the gridlock that John Rentoul spoke of earlier on. One upside of a gap now in the process between Mrs May resuming her authority and something happening back in Parliament in mid-Jan is the scope for further teasing out of exactly what the clarifications might be that can help people narrow their positions on this or narrow the gap between them. Talk is good in this bit, and you know, the next 2 days we have an EU leaders' summit. It is inconceivable that nothing at all will come out of that. There'll be some commentary. And Patrick Smith of the Irish Times had a very good analysis yesterday of something that I have to say I hadn't dwelt on myself, is that there are reasonable safeguards around the operation of the backstop so that neither side would end up being trapped in it. There's an arbitration mechanism that has a very fairly based independent review of either side feeling they are trapped permanently in the backstop, which is part of the sloganing around the backstop, that once you're in you can't get out. And I think the next couple of weeks could allow for a little bit of more reasoned contribution from interpreters that can say, actually, to those of you who are most worried about the backstop, and in Britain today the word backstop is just a slogan. And certainly in England, compared to the emotion that we attach to it on the island of Ireland. And for some people in Parliament, greater clarification about just how untrapping the backstop may actually be may be useful.
Lorraine?
Just from listening to the debates over the past couple of days, I've been quite alarmed at the actual level of knowledge that some of the MPs have, and quite senior MPs at that, the level of knowledge that they would have about the backstop, about any future trade agreements and the mechanisms around that. And I think we here are very much invested in it and our political system, and every politician in Ireland could talk ad nauseum with knowledge on Brexit and on the backstop. That's not the same in the UK. And I think a lot of them need to actually define their position, because they don't know where their position is and what an outcome. They're just trotting out the slogans, and they really need to start stepping up to the plate, being responsible politicians and looking at the danger that their own country is in and the constitutional crisis really that's coming down the track very, very rapidly with them.
Harry McGee, is there a sense around Leinster House of impending doom, of or is there a sense that, look, something will turn up, this will work out, or is there a genuine fear that we are approaching a cliff edge?
I use the metaphor of pulling on the national jersey, because last time that was used was during the recession 10 years ago, and I don't want to be the kind of harbinger of something disastrous is happening. But there does seem to be, I think we might be talking about the confidence and supply agreement later on, but the Brexit loomed large in relation to the agreement of that today. And there does seem to be a lot of, I know that individual parties will bicker over aspects of the government's approach and what have you, but when you look at the overall approach, I think there's a lot of consensus and a lot of unity and a lot of determination. And I haven't sensed a sense of despair amongst any of the Irish political parties. They know the situation is grave. They know the situation could deteriorate. They know the prospect of a no deal is real. But they're not at a stage now where there's resignation or where they see that everything is going to unravel. And most of them are still optimistic. Maybe the degree, the moodometer might be a little bit lower than it was before, Katie, but there's most of them believe that some kind of deal may still be possible, even though the hard-nosed arithmetic is certainly pointing in the other direction.
I'm glad you said that, Harry, because I've just got a text in here. Does the media ever get tired of doom-mongering? I have been listening to this for every day for months. Another one, and any chance of a Brexit-free day on RTE?
No.
And another one here. There's no point in postponing the withdrawal date. It's like kicking the can down to the end of the road and then finding another road to kick the can down. Martin?
Yeah, look, I think ultimately there's probably there's a focus in government, as there is in the Dáil in general, that there are elements of this we can't control and there's elements that we can. And within the areas that we can control, we continue to progress those plans. So government initially, from the very first day with Brexit, put in place very significant preparations and plans. And from last July, we moved from a preparation phase and a planning phase to an implementation phase. And this week alone at a cabinet meeting yesterday, those plans stood it up a year again, and you know every State Department has now been told to prioritise.
I have to say, I listened to that and I thought, were they not prioritising it before? Now
we're
3 months away from what we always knew was to be the deadline.
Yeah, but so let's say every department has identified, for example, the legislation that would need to change in the circumstances of a No Deal Brexit, where you know there would need to be a separate reference to the UK because they would be a third country, and elements like that. So that has all been identified, but you know, let's say the actual work of drawing that legislation up, that it'd be ready to be brought through the House in January or February if necessary, or in late March, that is happening. So, you know, but the contingency that, plans that we have, and some of which can't all be talked about for national interest at this stage, but the contingency that are there, there is no greater contingency than probably the strength, stability and security that we are finding from our membership of the EU. And obviously there's elements that are...
But Martin, it's very worrying that the plans that you had put in place with revenue were paused and actually halted, and they've only been reactivated, and we're quite concerned about that. It was always a very, very real possibility that we'd be facing this situation, and we're far behind where we should be really in the Brexit plans.
We're not far behind where we should be in the Brexit plans.
But the thing is, we don't know though, do we, Martin, because we're not being told what the plans are.
Well, no, and there's some elements for national reasons, and if you take the debate in the UK in the last couple of weeks, wouldn't have been helpful if we were or a month or two ago openly talking about all no deal scenarios. But that planning has been in place. It is stepping up. As I say, we've been in the implementation phase, and then there's obviously the elements that are within our domestic element, but there's the 70 papers from the European element that we have to deal with collectively along with the other 26 member states, and there's been 70 different detailed papers published most recently, I think November.
Do we have the capacity within the civil service to actually cope with this in the short time frame now that we are facing into?
There is no doubt a no deal Brexit would provide a range of challenges, and as a country we would be looking to deal with all of them, but there is probably no ability to fully prepare for the circumstances.
The Revenue Commissioners, actually Tony Connolly broke a story about the Revenue Commissioners. They had a special team that looked into the implications of Brexit for customs, for export duties, and they produced an extraordinary report. It was scarifying. So scarifying, in fact, that its work was stopped there and then.
That was when they were told to step back from...
They were told to step back, but I'm sure they're looking back at that report now and dusting it down and saying, oh my God, maybe this actually might become a reality.
If you even look, let's say, for the UK, over the 44 years of the UK's membership, I think they've signed up to something like 750 different treaties, and they would all cease and end on the 29th of March. The idea that can be all done in a seamless way is, you know, it's why we need to avoid a no-deal Brexit. There is no doubt about that. But in relation to the elements that we deal with collectively, that paper on the 13th of November is one of 70 where it deals with most of the, and nearly all of the queries that the aviation industry would have, let's say, in maintaining open skies policy across Europe and to make sure that our planes can still fly after it's been
done. Okay, the reality for real businesses is that if we're looking at something as short as a two-month contingency period in which to get ready for the great unknown, that's just not realistic.
I was just
and
going
we
to
are
put
moving
you, John,
into some space that talks about emergency provisions across the European system to say there are certain things that cannot be prepared for in that space of time, and we need some transitionary measures, which some EU nations are beginning to talk about quite dangerously, actually. Any action on this needs to be comprehensive and uniform across all EU member states by a protocol with the UK for some quasi-transition period.
I was just going to put you a tweet from John O'Brien from Maynooth University, who obviously has a big interest in this. And he's tweeting, and another 35 odd days wasted before the UK even gets to that decisive parliamentary vote. Dreadful for the business community in particular.
He's right.
Theresa Reedy also.
I think as well that a lot of people that actually are going to be directly affected by Brexit still don't really know where they stand. And I think even some of your texters earlier, you know, touched on that in terms of people are kind of feel, oh, Brexit, we're kind of Brexited out, Brexit fatigue. But the reality is, if we don't have a deal or we have like a hard border situation, it's going to really negatively affect a lot of people. So I think, you know,
I think, in fairness, we need to get that information out. The Irish government is acutely aware of that. That's why Leo Riker was speaking on the phone.
There's a lot of businesses and just general people that would be crossing over the border every day that still
absolutely.
But the volatility, they're the ones that are going to be affected by it. There are a lot of people living this side of the border and work in the north, and they get paid in sterling, and they're seeing the value of their wages dropping rapidly. And there's some very, very frightened people living along the border who cross over and back and do their business, work, go to school, and we need to start seriously protecting those people. They're at the coalface of this, and even in North County Dublin, vegetable producers producers are getting very, very scared by this.
And there's no doubt the opportunity tomorrow that the Taoiseach has with the other at the council, the EU council of state heads of state, you know, as an opportunity for him to bring home those points, as all of our ministers do at all of their relevant meetings across Europe, to make sure that all of our European colleagues are aware of the challenges we face.
Okay. Okay. We will take a break there, but stay with us because we want to talk about the extension of the confidence and supply deal.
Tweet at Late Debate RTE. The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And you're welcome back. In studio with us this evening, we have Martin Hayden, Lorraine Clifford-Lee, Kathleen Funchian, John McGrain and Harry McGee. Well, disarray in Westminster, but peace and harmony in Dáil Éireann, with news today that Micheál Martin that Fianna Fáil's confidence and supply arrangement will continue through 2019 with a view to an election in early 2020. He spoke to Ciarán Shanley earlier this evening.
It is difficult for us, but we're doing it in the national interest, and and I believe it's right for the country. The country is more important than the party in any given day, and I think the general public, I think, will respond positively, notwithstanding the impatience that is there in terms of the failure to deliver on housing, the failure to deliver on health, okay, the imbalance in terms of rural Ireland and the delay in broadband. We get all of that, and we will be holding the government to account. We will be keeping up the pressure on government in terms of these very issues over the coming months.
Lorraine, you've given Leo Varadkar a free pass here. What did you get in return for another 12 months of a Fine Gael government?
Well, it's what the country gets, and the country gets stability. And Micheál Martin was quite clear in saying that we're not operating in normal times. If we were in normal times, we wouldn't be continuing with this. And that's quite clear, and from what he said to us last night at the parliamentary party as well. But we're not in normal times, and we need to give the country stability.
Okay, we'll take that as a given. Mm-hmm. But you could still, I mean, you've been in 6 weeks of review, negotiation, whatever was happening in all those 16 to 18 meetings, however many meetings were had. Was there not any discussion about, you know, nailing down a few key concessions that could be taken back to the parliamentary party and shown to the country and said, look, we're doing this again. We know a lot of people have issues with this confidence and supply arrangement, but look, here's what we're going to get for it.
Well, we will be doing that, and we'll be outlining our legislative priorities.
But you've shown your hand now.
No, that's not the case, Katie, because the confidence and supply arrangement actually lasted, or was supposed to last, for the lifetime of the government, and there was supposed to be a review at the end of the 3-year period. We've done that review. We're very clear on where all the government departments are standing right now, and we will be getting our concessions as we're going along. But we need to provide stability for the country. Like, you saw the chaos in the UK this week and before that, and, you know, we can't have that instability here, and I think that's what we've done. A lot of people aren't happy about it within our own party and beyond that, but an election would just cause 3 or 4 months of chaos here, and we can't afford to have that. You've got people that are desperately worried about their livelihoods, about their businesses, and we have to give that
but
stability.
Have you got people
right now.
Have you got people in Fianna Fáil desperately worried about their seats? I mean, is this convenient? I'm not suggesting that it's cynical, but is it convenient that we can say, look, we can't hit you now because you've got Brexit in your arms?
Well, there's a lot of people in Fianna Fáil, and I'd include myself in that cohort, that would be looking for a Dáil seat, and I'd much prefer to be sitting in Dáil Éireann, quite frankly, than in Shannadarran, and I hope to be in the future. But it's about putting the party to one side and thinking about the future of the country.
Martin Hayden, was Fine Gael surprised that Fianna Fáil were willing to grant this 12-month extension without demanding something up front?
Well, look, as somebody who sat on the Fine Gael team over the last 7 weeks in those negotiations...
Did you discuss? Were there concessions discussed and dismissed?
No, the discussion that there was a review of the confidence and supply arrangement and the in-depth analysis of all of the state departments, bringing in senior officials and looking at where we're at in each of the areas, the levels of achievement and the levels of challenges we face in a whole variety of areas. And I think there was a cognizance from the Fianna Fáil representatives on their team of the challenges that are faced. And, you know, they asked them probing questions, and you know, we lifted a bonnet on a number of different issues, and I think it was a good process. It was about 40 hours of meetings in total.
Your Taoiseach didn't seem to think so. He thought it should have been wrapped up by Halloween.
Well, no, actually, what the Taoiseach wanted from last July was to avoid a scenario where we're, like Brexit, in a cliff edge date coming up to the end of the year.
At your party conference that a lot of impatience about how long this process was taking. So now you're telling us it was a really good process.
No, look, it was a good process. There was an impatience that it didn't start till October, because what we wanted to avoid, and again, the Taoiseach, when he met with Micheál Martin, was looking that those discussions would maybe begin in September before the Dáil came back, because Leo Varadkar knew well that we get into this period now. You know, this week alone, Pascal Donohue on our team is in Washington. Simon Coveney was in Brussels on Monday and Tuesday. It's not the ideal time to be doing these negotiations at the height of such time. But, you know, Fianna Fáil had their timeline, and that was the timeline
those discussions and do our diplomacy behind doors, not on the airwaves like Leo Varadkar wanted to do. And
it's hard to know what the discussions were about, because it seems like absolutely nothing came out of it. Like, I find it incredible that even if you just look at the housing crisis on its own, that there wouldn't be some deal that Fianna Fáil would try and get out of that.
But you want to throw the country into instability and have no government here for a number of
months.
Okay, one voice. Yeah, and in fairness, I didn't interrupt you. We have 4,000 children that are going to wake up in hotel rooms this Christmas morning.
I'm
not surprised with Fianna Fáil, given that they stood over everything in relation to the Garda Commissioner stuff last year, the ongoing crisis.
Yeah, and Sinn Féin sat back for 10 weeks and didn't even negotiate or engage in any negotiations after the last general election.
He criticises and he says, yes, there's loads of issues around rural Ireland, broadband. Yes, there's issues around housing. Yes, there's issues around
housing. And Sinn Féin want to have 4 months.
What they basically do is absolutely nothing. Okay, you didn't get anything.
Sinn Féin will never get anything, because you'll sit back and not put yourselves forward to do anything.
Care about the negotiations, because that's all that was agreed.
Okay, Harry.
Well, they did spend a long time reviewing the last confidence and supply agreement in some considerable depth, and when they announced it today, the lack of information was just startling. Miriam Lord actually has a very good colour piece, which I said, Micheál, he was out the plinth this afternoon, and she said Micheál couldn't have been more vague had he explained the contents through the medium of interpretive dance. And the only thing that we've learned is that there's some Fianna Fáil legislation that has been delayed that needs to be hurried. But all of the stuff about housing, about broadband, about health, and all the serious shortcomings that were revealed allegedly by Fianna Fáil during the course of negotiations.
And we're not happy about
what they are and what they're going to do about them. So it looks like you opened the bonnet of the car, had a look in, said, Jesus, there's big problems there with the engine, lads. And then you close the bonnet.
And we looked across the water and there are even bigger problems there and even greater anxieties. What were we supposed to do, Harry?
Well, to
have 4 months of instability while we have a general election and negotiate.
These are the issues that have been identified. This is what has been agreed, and this is how we're going to proceed.
And we're not happy about it, and we were quite clear in saying that if this was normal times.
But nobody knows what you were unhappy about, Lorraine.
But we need to at this point, offer that stability to the country, because there are a lot of people out there. I'm out knocking on doors, and as are my colleagues, and Micheál Martin is right across the country, and people are genuinely anxious and worried about Brexit.
But Lorraine, with the best will in the world, I think it is very surprising that you come through 6 weeks of what we're told are very intense discussions, reviews, SecGens are being brought in, officials being brought in, as Martin said, you looked under the bonnet. And at the end of it all, you announce, we've decided to give you another 12 months. We'll come back to you again about, you know, the things
it's not about deciding to give Fine Gael another 12 months.
But ultimately, that is what happened. You've decided to support this arrangement for another 12 months.
What we've decided to do is give the country the stability that's absolutely needed. When we look across the water, we see the absolute chaos there. And it could very
So you're saying in any circumstances right now that this government could do anything and that Fianna Fáil would say, look, under the circumstances, we have to support it.
This government cannot do anything. Like, if you look at the under the terms of the confidence and supply arrangement that has been in place for the past number of years, that there is a process there by which the two parties can sit down and tease out any issues, because we've gone into this in good faith, and I take it that Fine Gael and the Independents have gone in, and I presume that they are going to conduct this in good faith for the next 12 months to give the country the stability.
But even for a bit of political cover, would you not have produced some document, some sense that you have nailed down, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5?
And we will be doing that. And that's what we've done, that the three budgets that we have allowed pass, we have gotten concessions, and we will be doing that in the next budget as well. But we can't at this point start playing around and start making a political football of this very sensitive time.
Okay, we are going to have to leave it there. We have every paper leading with the Theresa May vote this evening. We have the headline in the London Metro, Keep May and Carry On. The Examiner's telling us not going anywhere for now. The Financial Times, May survives Brexiter challenge, but margin fails to quash revolt. And The Guardian, Tory coup fails, but scale of rebellion damages May. And that's it. Tonight's programme was produced by Brian Lally. Research was by Abby Philbin-Bowman. The broadcast coordinator was David Phelan. And Kieran Dunn was on sound. I want to thank all my panel. And now it's over to Colin Murray on Late Date.